face interrogation on your own.
For no reason, I got snatched by CPD. Seem like they following me. I asked for my call. Guard says not bothering me. 800 Lara 4. Thank God my homie called for me.
Think of what you have in store when you call 1-800 Lara 4. You can get a lawyer. Call him up. Maybe you in Chicago. 1-800 Lara 4. 1-800 Lara 4.
Views and opinions expressed by callers, guests, and hosts do not necessarily reflect those of the Black Talk Radio Network and Black Talk Media Project. Black Talk Radio is new black media for the new millennium.
Najim Weed, co-host of Race Treaty. We have a very exciting program for you tonight. I'm very happy to report that through all our comings and goings, we have contacted some of the most astute human rights activists in the country. And tonight we have the pleasure of having one of those activist who is a staunch human rights advocate to be on our show tonight, and that is the illustrious Vicky Casanova Willis. So tonight's broadcast is having a conversation with Vicky, who happens to be the president of the National Conference of Black Lawyers, as well as she's on the National Steering Committee for Human Rights Cities. And as the first half hour of the show, we will be speaking with her about who she is, about her organization, and her plans as now the new co-host of Race Treaty. And then from the second half hour of the show, she will have guests on. Eliza Soloise, if I'm saying it correctly.
Hey, Eliza. Yes. Hey, and I actually got Eliza to join us earlier in this call. I think it would be great for both of us to be able to chat with this leader in the basically civil and human rights arena. So please continue, and thank you for that great introduction of myself. I'm honored and humbled.
Wonderful. So Eliza will, as I understand it, is Executive Director of First Defense Legal Aid, FDLA, an organization that surprisingly offers free 24/7 legal defense to ensure arrestee civil and human rights consultation, which is quite a wonderful thing to have in any day, and certainly in these days and times there in Chicago. And also joining the conversation later today will be Charles Jones. He should be calling in probably half an hour from now, and he's with organization right. Know Your Rights. He's a peer educator also for FDLA, that is the First Defense Legal Aid, and also he works with Ceasefire, violence prevention counselor, that testified before the UN Working Group on Arbitrary Detention in recent months, and I would believe that Ceasefire is part of the National Cure Violence Program, of which I happen to be a counselor, a social worker in the New York area. So we'll find if that link is actually so. So to our listening audience, we'd like to welcome Vicky Casanova Willis. Good evening.
Thank you so much. And again, it's such a privilege and a pleasure always to be able to speak with you, to share with the audience on Rice Treaty and to talk with the very sophisticated audiences of Black talk radio that really are delving into some of the most pressing ongoing issues, not just of our time, but historically, and to be given the opportunity to join and come on board as, you know, one of the hosts for the upcoming season is a privilege. One of the things that immediately came to mind was to really, of course, tap into the circle that I work with directly right here in Chicago, day in and day out. And so, full disclosure, I want you to know that I work not only with NCBL and the U.S. Human Rights Network, as you mentioned, in the Human Rights Cities National Steering Committee, but also very much with First Defense Legal Aid and this circle of really groundbreaking leaders who have been moving forward with human rights at the local level for a very long time, even though it's not always called that. So that's really part of the practical reason for asking and encouraging Eliza Solovier, who is the executive director of an organization that's really confronting some of the most egregious rights violations firsthand and can help us understand how this is a part of bringing human rights home. So, Eliza, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Yes, and I happen to know that there's been some, despite the challenges of working with interrupting mass incarceration and false confessions, et cetera, there's actually been some very good news that you all have been able to report very recently as evidence of why you keep working so hard. So would you just tell us a bit about what you do, why it's so important, and what you've been able to share lately?
Yes, ma'am. Thank you. Well, for 20 years, more than 20 years, we've had attorneys volunteer to be on call every minute of day and night. So if we get our hotline from someone whose loved one was just arrested, we can actually deploy to the stations and provide legal aid on an emergency basis in that situation to protect the arrestee's rights. Everybody knows the Miranda warnings, right? I think we can remember seeing crime dramas and Hollywood movies and recite those.
Right.
And in fact, everybody has those rights. But in Chicago, almost no one is able to access them despite us being available and organized. We found out yesterday that last year, more arrestees than ever before got legal aid and police custody. It is because of our work, but it's because of a broad, long, strong police accountability movement who has really gained some ground, I think, in the last couple of years. But when I say the highest rate of access to counsel on record for Chicago arrestees, you know, the number that we got is not really to celebrate, other than that it's just the highest of any other year. Do you guys want to guess what percent? Knowing that 100% of arrestees have the right to counsel, just like the Miranda warning state, what percent you think really got it in Chicago police stations last year?
And Anaja, that question is for you, because I read the
article. That's right.
And I saw some of the FOIA
you were there
report
when
results.
The FOIA request came back, yeah.
Exactly.
Okay, so tell me the question. Ask me the question again.
So guess. Okay, so knowing that everybody has the right to a lawyer when they're under arrest, what percent do you think actually got a lawyer in that situation last year?
In Chicago.
Chicago. Mm-hmm.
I would probably say 5%.
Okay, maybe soon. Last year it was 1%.
Oh my goodness.
Actually 0.97%, but we're rounding up. And we're celebrating because that is five times what it was in 2013, right? It was just 2 in 1,000 or 0.2% that actually got a lawyer mm-hmm. at any station in Chicago. And so every year since then, we've seen it climb, really because, you know, talk to Charles about this, because of his work and many others who have made sure that people know who to call, how to call, how to stand up for their rights. But they also were able to reveal a real policy reason why people weren't calling from the station, and that's because the police weren't giving people the phones. So really, we can only help when somebody knows our number and can call it for somebody else. And, you know, we think that those policy changes can happen soon just because of the power and momentum of this grassroots Know Your Rights campaign. And
can I jump in really quickly?
Yes.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. So I just wanted to frame for Onaje and our listeners. So, you know, of course, as Eliza says appropriately, you know, it's hard to be proud of those numbers, right? 1% of arrestees, and we know that it's actually much lower for our youth, right, for juveniles. Yeah. But it's a five-fold increase just over the last few years with the dedicated work of individuals who are not deterred by the fact that people's civil and human rights are violated on a daily basis. They continue to educate, right, and to advocate for what is right, even if the law, as it's written, is discriminatory or, you know, falls short of the promise of the Constitution. So that is, for me, an immediate connection to what we know are really human rights, is a human rights mindset, right? And so that's, for me, part of the benefit of everyday people really understand the difference, right? But also that this is not some esoteric concept that only applies to international, you know, problems or, you know, people going to Geneva, Switzerland to testify perhaps and then coming back. It is very directly related to things that we can do right here, right now.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. And what's at stake in Chicago when people, especially Black people, Black young people, Black people exposed to violence and whose communities have been divested in terms of clinics being closed, schools being closed, you know, when people are in contact with police, so many human rights violations ensue that we can help prevent. And the most obvious is that these Miranda rights are not just civil rights, they're actually human rights. And they're some of the only human rights that are really codified into our civil law. You know, we in the U.S. don't have a right to housing. We have a human right to housing, but in terms of the U.S. government, we don't have a right to housing, right? But it is a human right that we not be alone with police and prosecutors, but can actually have a lawyer. And so, you know, while these rights exist as an abstraction, we want to make them real. And it's a real entry point for more people to get involved in human rights organizing, because it's not just, you know, the right to counsel that we're providing for. When young people are stopped and, you know, really molested by police on the streets because, you know, maybe they're wearing their pants low, and police take that as a, instead of, you know, a right to cultural and subcultural expression, take it as a reason to stop somebody, you know, that's a right violation,
right,
in terms of our
mm-hmm.
cultural rights. And, you know, it's also being held alone with police and prosecutors is by definition, in terms of UN, you know, international human rights law, that is torture in itself, right? Even with nothing else
Correct.
Violent happening,
mm-hmm.
to hold, you know, be held by state agents with guns and badges and not be allowed to talk to your loved ones and your attorney, that fits the definition of torture. So, and, you know, there are so many intricacies and different human rights that are implicated by police impunity. And so we are really trying to intervene in the mass incarceration, in disproportionate minority confinement, and really develop and follow the leadership of people who are most affected by that, to see a real change in that and a lot of suffering being prevented in the future.
I'm just you got a question, Onaje?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you know, it's been said that grandmother makes the best fried chicken around, and everybody wants to get grandma's recipe. So I think we have a good recipe here in terms of, you know, at least in this first instance, in terms of knowing what our rights are, in terms of having the right to counsel, and then now beginning to record, as you have done in Chicago, what has been the percentage at which defendants have, in fact, had access to a lawyer. And of course, those numbers are abominable. But now I would like us to uses as a template in terms of every city, any place where there's a concentration of Black people, to start to collect this data. And this is one of the reasons why this show exists. We are here to certainly speak about the covenants and assist in the organizing and put things in place right now. What can we do? And you have given us an example of what we can do just in terms of each city being able to collect these statistics. So I guess the first question I and maybe the listening audience may have is, how do we get the statistics to know who has been given access to counsel in New York City, in Philadelphia, in Jackson, Mississippi, so forth and so on?
Mm-hmm. Well, what we were able
Elijah,
to do...
I'll let you answer.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. So a few years ago, we were talking to police leadership about one particular facility that is actually an abandoned warehouse where we knew they were taking people and holding them. And when we would show up and say, I want to see my client, their family's concerned, we know they're in there, they would say, oh no, this is too high security, no lawyers allowed. And so when we talked to the city leadership about it, they said, oh, we wouldn't deny people access to counsel. And so what we agreed to is that they would document every time an attorney showed up at one of their facilities asking to see their client. And so once they started documenting that, that made that information subject to the Freedom of Information Act. And so we could say, you know, really just write down on a piece of paper, Freedom of Information Act request on top. I request to know how many people have you arrested and how many had attorneys show up, right? And so for us, we could say how many attorney visitation forms were filled out. And because they keep track of that, they have to respond by law and tell us. So when we asked that, you know, we got back some numbers like 143,000 some arrests and 300 attorney visitation forms that first year that they had kept records. And we did the math, you know, just dividing out and getting the percentage that meant 0.2% had a lawyer out of all of those arrests. So that's how we did it. And so I think you might want to find out in your city or county how police actually process an attorney visit. And, you know, it may help to use their language, but even without knowing what their procedure is and how they document it, you can write on a piece of paper, Freedom of Information Act request, please tell me how many people you arrested and how many had a lawyer show up at the station. And there are some, maybe there's a local legal aid clinic that can help, because there are a few loopholes that government agencies can use to get around responding and having to respond. But that's the basic, you know, to find that stat in your area.
Mm-hmm. So it seems
and
to
it's
me.
Also, oh, I'm sorry. No, Jay, I just wanted to mention so that, you know, again, make framing this and much of our work in from a human rights perspective, whether or not that was the intent, there also is a proactive responsibility on the part of every nation state, according to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and many of the treaties that have been ratified, in our case by the U.S., there's a proactive responsibility to track and document these sorts of things, right? So this is it's not happening, right? So this is an example of a local entity, a local organization, just collaborating with, you know, and thinking through, well, what do we really need, right? What do we really need to ensure that justice is served here? And starting to request that information. When we talk about stakeholders' reports, right, the reports that need to be framed in order to raise issues at the international level and seek remedies that we or recommendations that we can then bring back home, that's one of the first places is to have that, you know, data-based exemplar. So the other thing is even for a school to do a report card of, you know, what is happening in our community that wouldn't be happening if we were a human rights city, for example. So I wanted to thank you just for sharing that kind of basic foundational work that's happening here. I just want to share a couple of things because I know that we're going to have to let Eliza go and, you know, a little bit over 10 minutes or so, but Chicago is one of the cities that has actually provided a resolution on the rights of the child. I'll just put it that way, adopting the rights of the child. I wanted to ask you for some information that you're aware of how that came to be. We know that there's a long way to go in terms of actually giving it teeth, making it mean something, but how did the people even get their local municipality to agree to something that right now the U.S. is one of the only remaining nations, I'm shocked, and societies that won't ratify that treaty. How did that happen?
I remember some Black youth in my neighborhood who had been very directly affected by human rights violations, from housing rights to education rights. I mean, in our neighborhood, there aren't even enough seats to fit all the teenagers if they did go to school. And, you know, the rights to recreation, having no safe, healthy, you know, highest quality places to play, you know, all these rights, you know, it's really a cradle to prison pipeline that is created with all these human rights violations. So some young people who had learned that that's what they were experiencing and that there were these things called human rights and that they had the right to dignity and transparency and accountability from the government that was making these choices, you know, we're working on some specific, you know, issue-specific campaigns, but we're really conscious of the connections between them. And they, along with some other, you know, organizations, kind of quote-unquote civil society, academic groups, met a few times and drafted what became the city council's resolution, which is just, you know, kind of a toothless promise to say that although the United States hasn't committed to protect the human rights of children, we do as a city government. It's not something that's binding. I can't sue and say, oh, you know, how'd you knock down my house when I have the right to housing and you know, and I have a child, so you violated their rights. There's not something
like that. They'll close all the schools in my neighborhood.
Right, close all the right. schools, close half the mental health clinics. But it's still, you know, at this point, and that was, shoot, it must have been 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. But at this point, it's something we can use to say, hey, this is what we said that we would hold ourselves as members of the city accountable for, right? And here are some violations. And, you know, going back to the Freedom of Information Act request, even if there wasn't the Freedom of Information Act, right, it's a human right to know about decisions, and that it's a human right to accountability. So people directly affected by human rights violations have the right to play leadership and hold accountable you know, government entities and budgets to actually help solve those problems. So, you know, now there is an opportunity to really see how this could inform our city's resources being put towards human rights before profit interests and really be an accountability tool. Because even without the Freedom of Information Act responses, people know what's happening. And so there are ways to, you know, create
exactly.
our own surveys, implement our own surveys, collect our own stories, and document those truths and mm-hmm. use those truths to insist on a better way.
I'm going to ask you one other quick question, and this is not directly related to the work that First Defense Legal Aid does on a daily basis, but you have, speaking of those great stories that can really reinforce, you know, the power of the people, you had shared something with folks about the history on the west side of Chicago in particular, not only there, but west side activists, just everyday people who had a unique approach to getting the attention of our elected officials, I guess, decades ago now, with regard to a lead problem. Do you mind sharing that?
Yes,
that's
total
love
the power of the
rights
people story. Okay.
Yes.
So I'm actually standing right now on the west side of Chicago, and there's just so many awesome stories of human rights triumphs. And one of them I heard is that in advance of Dr. King coming to Chicago in the summer of 66, there was actually a year or more where members of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference were out here really building relationships and getting to know and support Westsiders, who at the time really, you know, throughout the city were known to have been experiencing the most human rights violations from, you know, like I said, from housing, schools, et cetera. And one thing that the families here had noticed was something was going on with the babies that seemed to be an environmental toxin. They learned something about lead poisoning and brought their concerns to the city to say, please, you know, let's have some regulations and some expectations enforced in terms of our buildings and our environment, not poisoning our babies. And the city said, what are you talking about? You know, you don't know anything. You know, we don't have time to meet with you. You know, move on. And they actually were trained each other to be doing lead testing, urine tests, to actually gather that information and do that research that could not be denied. And they did it, right? There were certain housing units that became clinics to get this done. And when they came back to the city and said, you know, we need an ordinance, we need a law that says every kid will be tested for lead before going into the Chicago public schools, and there will be standards and consequences when landlords and other property owners, you know, make choices and end up poisoning them. And the city again said, well, no, that's not on our agenda, this council meeting. And I heard that basically the organizers and residents came back and said, well, if you don't believe us, there's a problem. We're about to deliver so many quarts of urine to City Hall during your meeting. And then, you know, as I heard it told by Dr. Bernard Lafayette, who, you know, was involved at the time, you know, then all of a sudden it did become part of the agenda. Their, you know, their concerns were addressed. And, you know, we do have some city regulations now that have helped, you know, reduce the problem of lead poisoning, but it still exists. But I do think that's just, you know, the things that we can all do together to gather and prove what we're experiencing, and not take no for an answer when it comes to government accountability for human rights.
Exactly. So I there are so many things that people are speaking about even on a daily basis that, you know, can seem very hopeless and that you're really running into a brick wall. And you know, there's always a way if you just keep moving and keep pushing. So I love that story. And as you said, there are so many. We have just a few more minutes with you, and we certainly would hope that, you know, down the road and in the future that we'll continue to be able to touch bases and hear additional information about, you know, struggles and victories as the collaborative work continues. And something you said earlier made me want to ask you a little bit as we're wrapping up your time here with regard to the sanctuary cities conversation that's happening for a lot of people. And I'm just wondering about, especially with your work with First Defense Legal Aid and my work with the Human Rights Cities in movement, really trying to help people think through where are there's intersectionality is a word that a lot of people share. I'm wondering if you could share your thoughts with us today just on where the Sanctuary Cities movement, which is under threat right now, might fit within this circle of all the work that we still need to do.
I mean, to me, you know, a sanctuary is a place that you can go to be safe, and where people there are looking out for you and your needs and your comfort. And so our mayor has promised Chicago will be a sanctuary city for immigrants who are at risk of deportation. And, you know, to me, to be a real sanctuary city means to be a human rights city. To be safe, you know, we need all of the things that every human deserves. And right now, really a human rights issue of our time, a racial justice issue of our time, is of course the mass incarceration of Black Americans. And Chicago is famous for our police force torturing Black people, Black children. And so, you know, if this is a sanctuary city, there is a lot of work to do from the city government's role in making sure that Black people can also find sanctuary here, not just Black immigrants, but everybody. And so that's the connection that I see, and I definitely heard yesterday from many grassroots community organizations led by people of color directly affected, saying, you know, these fights are won, right? Safety and health and human rights for our immigrants here in Chicago can't exclude the human rights needs and deserts of Black Chicago.
That's just powerful. I want to thank you so much. I really, really appreciate your agreeing to come on and talk with us and share some of the work and your perspective on how, you know, both civil rights and human rights work can be so interconnected. And we, Onaje, do you have any other questions or parting thoughts for Eliza as she signs off? And then we can talk for a couple of minutes, and then we'll have Charles join us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I want to thank you as well. And certainly you have to come back to tell us all of, I got the A through the A through Z, but I know there's 20, at least 25 other letters to cover.
Thank you so much. I'll be tuning in as a listener to hear you do that.
and I want to
thank you so much.
We ask you to let all of your staff, all of those, your board members, all who are connected to you and your work, that this show exists for you. It's a platform to broadcast to the world who you are, what you're doing, and how we can work together. Because only together will we, in fact, have a fighting chance of our survival and our progress. So the number to the audience, if people are having a live show, is 828-385-4922. And if you do a Google search for Race Treaty, you will find not only access to this show through the network, but also podcasts. So every show that we do, it's open to the audience, not only at the time that it's recorded or that it's aired, but also for further listening pleasure later on. So we ask you to send out to your listserv that you were a guest on the show, that you would encourage them to listen to this podcast, and of course, stay and remain, you know, active listeners and also advocates of the show. So we want to thank you so very much.
Will do. Thank you.
Thank you so much. That was Eliza Salovier, the Executive Director of First Defense Legal Aid in Chicago, Illinois, sharing with us a really unique, but not new, over 20 years in practice, very unique, completely free, 24/7 access to legal counsel under arrest at the police station, so that no one ever has to be alone with police and prosecutors without their constitutional, and now we're hearing human rights, to representation and to counsel without having that be a real right that can be accessed. And so what's interesting is this, although it is operating in Chicago, and we do want to caution people always, you know, when you Google and you look at the toll-free number for the hotline, just so that people are clear, that's not currently in your municipality, but it could be. This literally for 20 years through grassroots and then, you know, small volunteer nonprofit organization demonstrated that it is possible to make the promise of the Miranda right to remain silent and that you have a right to the lawyer, a lawyer, real. So if it can happen in Chicago, it can happen anywhere. And we're going to continue to work with those folks on all sides of whatever divides there may be to continue to increase the amount of people that actually have access to this free service as well. It can make a tremendous difference. And one of the things that she shared was that 60 Minutes actually was the source that had revealed the statistics confirming that Chicago is the false confession capital of the U.S., not something to be proud of. So that means that it's not about opposing the police or letting someone who is breaking the law off, you know, without being held accountable. What it means is that all of those people who were falsely imprisoned and you know, would not have been had they had their right to counsel respected. So, Onaje, thank you for welcoming me in this new role, and as well as, you know, some of our guests.
I wanted to chat with you a little bit before Charles is able to join us, just about, again, what did you hear in that last conversation that reinforces, hopefully you did, it reinforces the work that we are doing to help really build a human rights cities movement here in the United States?
You're very astute, because that question was on my mind. And what I see is that's coming into view is a checklist, right? A human rights activist mm-hmm. checklist. And one mm-hmm. is to find out the statistics of how many people are being arrested, and also to find out how many people, in fact, had a lawyer, and start to record that on a daily basis for every town and city that we start to organize with. The second thing that I heard from that is contributory to the human rights movement is that the successes that people have already achieved but are hidden from view because people don't know about it. Only people involved know about it. So the whole thing about the water, I never heard about that before. And I'm quite sure that many people in Chicago have never heard about that, nor do they know the victory of the people organizing and making sure that they had their issue heard and they got resolution and that it became part of city council in terms of regular city policy. And of course, right. The first thing, which was really quite extraordinary, and I don't know of any other city that has done this, where they have, in fact, inculcated the rights of the child on a city level and through the council in terms of regular local legislation. That is the whole purpose of human rights cities. That is to bring the greatest human rights thinking as represented at this point through the treaties, the covenants and the treaties,
exactly.
And the conventions, bringing them into local implementation in terms of local law. So there was no fanfare about it. It wasn't on the NBC News or ABC, whatever have you. So it shows the importance of this particular radio program so that it can be announced to our listening audience that one, these struggles have been fought. These struggles have been won, and these struggles have produced results in terms of the quality of life that people are actually experiencing. So those are the three main points that I got from your guest's testimony today.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And I will just share and echo what you just stated about the importance of Black media, and especially conscious Black media. We, again, are here in Chicago where the voice of the nation, right, WVON, is, really, really well known for helping ensure that stories that are not covered otherwise are going to be covered. And to be able to have this platform, and have this literally something that people can access internationally, right, through Race Treaty and the podcast, is just a powerful tool to share and exchange information. Because if something positive can happen, in one place, it can happen somewhere else. We don't have to reinvent the wheel. We do need to share best practices. But it does underscore the importance, really strong importance, of this programming. Also very focused for quite some time. I'm just learning about all the work that you all have done to ensure that our community really understands the very real access to the human rights framework and what that means, how to educate themselves, ourselves, and each other. To your point, what some of those wins are, and even what some of the losses are, because they're instructive for us to know what we need to do differently the next time, right? I think it's really, really powerful that, again, what you just mentioned about the initiative and the movement that helped bring the City Council of Chicago and the mayor to enacting a resolution. They didn't ratify the treaty. Technically, you cannot, but you can adopt it. With regards to protecting children, that was led by directly impacted youth. Of color, Black primarily, and they're advocates and they're, you know, they're heroes to me.
Yes, so, and Vicki, you have consistently, all the meetings that we've been in together, you know, it's not one where you have not brought the youth into the conversation and to form and to a regular consciousness, you've done it again. And this is so important. And that is to say, let's reach out to those young people. Let's reach out to those young people, have them as guests on the show, and let's organize it in such a fashion that we can talk to as many youth organizations around the country. So we're going to call this Black Youth Day. That's what we're going to call it. We're going to call it Black Youth Day. And we're going
to... That's a great idea.
We're going to talk to Scotty, the founder of this radio station, and see how much time we can have. And maybe we can even organize it so that on that day, all the shows that will happen for that day will focus on the youth. So we'll have a whole day of youth programming and bringing to this radio format this particular youth organization and the people who are involved with that, so they can share with other youth around the country. So we have to come up with a date, starting with us doing a Black Youth Show, and then hopefully the next step is to have a Black Youth Day where the whole station will focus on our youth, because they have to become integral and intimate with the process. They have to become co-hosts on this station. We cannot allow adults.
I absolutely love that idea. I really, really do. I'm so glad that you raised it. And again, there's so much. Well, we know this. We're seeing in the headlines, in media, and, you know, through social media, there is a great deal of strong leadership and collaboration and courageous demanding of and enforcing of rights that is happening in our youth movements. And there's also, as there always has been, a fierce and extremely punitive backlash, right, against that. So we, of all sectors of our population, need to be working with in solidarity. If we, you know, you're just making me think about how do I try to hold municipalities and, you know, nations, et cetera, accountable, corporations and schools accountable for protecting our children and respecting the rights of the child. If I don't make sure to put their voices first always, because I make every effort to remind other people, but this is a tangible way to do that. So I love it. Speaking of children, Charles Jones is a very, very active organizer and violence interrupter, I would guess is the way to say it. He's an interventionist. He's a coach. He works a great deal with youth in the communities as part of an organization and volunteering with, many of you all know it as Ceasefire. I believe that the name may be changing to something very clearly related to, you know, curing violence. And he also does work, there are a lot of intersections, a lot of collaboration. He also does work with First Defense Legal Aid. That's how I met him. Speaking truth to power and very courageously giving, we actually were at Northwestern Law School doing a taping and a teach-in, a lecture to a lot of law students, because these are those volunteers that serve in shifts, 4 to 6 hour shifts, to go to the stations anytime the hotline is called and they identified that someone literally has just been arrested and needs a lawyer for free. And that's how that it happened. So there's a lot of education work going on all the time, both to the volunteer attorneys or the pool, who do not have to be criminal lawyers, by the way. This is how this can happen in anybody's town or city. They don't have to be criminal lawyers. They just have to be able to have the brief 90-minute CLE training so that they know how, just as people have been getting trained to do legal observing, right, for the protest, in this, you know, the last year or so. They would get the training to know how to help invoke people's Fourth, Fifth, and Sixth Amendment rights and fulfill the Miranda promise at the station. And then that documentation, to your earlier point, of what happened, who was there, were there injuries, what was the, you know, the, everything from what was the temperature in the room and how long was it before the people were able to eat, all that has been crucial in helping ensure a better measure of justice when people are arrested and not leaving them to make statements that may or may not be true under duress that can land them in prison for all or part of the rest of their lives, not to mention the torture that we know has been happening here in Chicago. So Charles is, also has a heart for youth, as I was mentioning, and he's going to just speak up whenever. Charles, are you on yet?
Yes, I'm on. How you doing?
Oh, I thought I heard you join. I know you had to make a quick stop in your work in the community always. So, hi. So, Charles, we just had Eliza on, and I know that she was able to talk quite a bit about First Defense directly and a lot of the, in fact, she mentioned you right away in terms of the work in the community. I just mentioned the, you know, the lawyers and the folks that can actually go to the station. But by the way, for the listening audience, a lot of people think, well, that's what the public defenders do, but they cannot. The public defender comes after someone goes to court to receive bond, and by then it's often too late, much too late. It could be up to 72 hours that they've been alone with police and prosecutors, you know, encouraged to make statements just to, well, we know that filling our prisons and jails. So, Charles, you mentioned the other piece of this that's so critical, which is the work that you lead in the communities as part of street law and peer education to get the word out so that people literally know, I have this right and how to access it. So would you just share with us a little bit about the importance of the Know Your Rights work? And then I'm going to ask you shortly to share with Anaje your testimony and your, you know, the opportunity that you had to talk with the United Nations and on Working Group on Arbitrary Detention earlier when they were here. But for right now, just tell us a little bit about what you do, you're doing right now, every day.
Oh, okay. Well, I work full-time with Ceasefire. It's an anti-violence organization, and we deal with the high-risk population. What we mean by high-risk population, these are individuals more likely could become involved in violent activity. And we try to work with these individuals to try to curb their behavior before they act out on it. So I'm an outreach counselor. I work with 20 individuals as an outreach counselor with them. And I also work part-time with First Defense Legal Aid, and I'm a street law organizer. I do Know Your Rights organizing, and that I go around and teach young people about their rights when they're confronted with a Chicago Police Department or law enforcement. And the work that I do is really key that individuals that I work with know their rights, because they come in contact with law enforcement probably on a daily basis, and I would like to say more than anyone else. They are more likely to have their rights violated. For example, last year, less than 1% of the people accessed their right to counsel at the police station. And this is the only place in the United States where you get a free lawyer. So you would be like, well, why? You would get a free lawyer in Chicago, which is known as the false confession capital, and no one's calling an attorney. After doing a survey with this target population, I come to find out that the Chicago Police Department do not give guys phone calls when they get arrested. You do not get a phone call until you are booked and processed and in the back. And this has been confirmed in numerous meetings that we had with the CPD, and we have been trying to work on trying to get them to change their policies. And the reason that no one gets a phone call is like a loophole in the law in Illinois. In Illinois, a suspect get a phone call within a reasonable amount of time. And the problem with that is the word reasonable is subjective to the arresting officer, meaning he gives you a phone call when he feels it's reasonable to him. And reasonable to him is more likely after you are booked and processed in. So that's one of the huge problems that we are having right now. We have been trying to get the law changed. We've been circulating petition, trying to get the law changed to no avail. I'm trying to get the CPD to change their policy and say, well, get suspect a phone call within 1 hour or specific time period instead of relying on a subjective clause in the law. And that's been a problem. And that came to light by dealing with this target population, because you wonder, like, why nobody's calling to get a free lawyer? And that's how, you know, it's important,
right?
Because you get firsthand testimony by being on the front end.
Absolutely. So you just made me think about two things, at least, that we want to make sure the listening audience is grasping from what you just said. These are everyday, really directly impacted people, and primarily volunteers, who are just taking a very close look at what the actual experience is. And like you mentioned earlier, Anaje, based on what Eliza shared, documenting it so that you could kind of see the track record. But then they're also asking questions like, what does this mean? Why are they not getting the calls? Identifying those issues, and then actually advocating with elected officials in the state to change, right, to enact policy change. So
yeah.
Two things that I want you to know is that this team was critical in identifying that warehouse where people were being kind of disappeared, right? And Holman Square is the notoriously now known quote-unquote black site, right, where there was still detention and torture and so forth going on long, long after the many people think that it had stopped and that it was just one officer decades ago. That's not the case, but it's the people who identified it that kept raising this, even under threat of additional punishment, profiling, and what have you. The other thing, Charles, is that there was just recently a policy change that benefits certain our young people, so that this is important work, and we thank you for what you're doing. Can you share a little bit about what you feel is, you know, when we talk about human rights, in addition to the fact that it's just the right thing to do to respect people's human rights and not mistreat people? There's a treaty, right, against racial discrimination, and now there we know, the third. This is all heavily skewed against black people when you look at the numbers. But separately, what other benefits are there? Let's just say it wasn't just to do the right thing. You've seen some things in your work and your outreach as an anti-violence counselor that show that it actually has other benefits for society and for our community.
Yes. You have to look at it, because we look at it from every perspective, from criminal rights to civil rights, but you got to look at it from like a human rights perspective, because these are basic. We're talking about basic rights. You know, we're not talking about cable TV. We're not talking about, you know, extravagant lifestyles where it costs. We're talking about basic human rights. This is basic stuff. Right to a phone call.
At every level. Right.
Yeah. I mean, this is basic stuff. So looking at it from a human rights perspective is very important, because it's critical, because now it changes the dynamic of it, because, you know, you could debate criminal, proceed. You could debate civil. But you can't debate basic human rights violations. You can't debate that. It is it or it's not. You know, to have someone locked up at a station and disappear incognito, can't communicate with family members, friends, and no one else, especially with a history as rich as Chicago, with the John Berg and other little things that went on, is very important. It's very, very key. And to address it from a human rights perspective, and me having opportunities to testify in front of the United Nations was very, very, very compelling.
So what,
people,
right, no, I was going to say, I appreciate your mentioning that. So what you shared in part with the United Nations Working Group on Arbitrary Detention was also like some of the transformation that you have seen from people once they learn what their rights are and start to invoke them, even if the you know, law enforcement is not yet fully recognizing them. What are some of the things that come from just people knowing their rights and starting to access them?
Well, let's look at Chicago. Right now, we're in the forefront for two things. We're in the forefront for violence, and in the streets. And we're also at the forefront for lack of accountability when it comes to law enforcement. And if you look closely, there's a correlation between the two. Now, when you deal with the target population I deal with, they don't have no respect when it comes to the law. So in turn, they act out and they take the anger and aggression back to their communities. And that's what you have. Violence on the rise and it's lack of accountability when it comes to those that are supposed to be policing them. They feel we have no rights. Why should I respect the law? Why should I even care? You know, and that's what we got going on right now. And if you hold those law enforcement accountable, I believe violence will go down and will decrease. Because then you can teach young people, hey, you know, the law works for everybody, not just some. And people think that that's like a far-fetched concept, but it's not. If you look at the prison population, if you take away the grievance process, the inmates' ability to complain and file legitimate complaints and have them addressed, violence goes up in prison. When you address prison concerns and grievances, violence in prison goes down. So,
right.
you see, it's the same thing that we have out here today. So when we hold those accountable, they're supposed to be policing us, the young people feel they develop respect for society, develop respect for law, they develop respect for order, and that's one of the things that we have right now. And if you don't see the correlation there, you got to be like, blind as Stevie Wonder. Anyone can see this. You know, it's like we're in the forefront of two things right now. Up in the forefront, Chicago mentioned two things, police and the violence. And you don't see a correlation there. And young people not knowing their rights when the police do things to them, they have no rights. So they become used to how they raise violence. They think there's no procedures for the police to slap them upside their head, have them pull their pants down in public. They think it's normal. They think that this is, the police have a right to do this. So they don't even know their rights. They don't know their basic rights. They don't even know their basic human rights. So they feel dehumanized and don't even know it. Don't even know it because they feel less than human. They feel like, well, we're nobody. They could treat us like they could do this to us. You know, and that's what's going on right now.
This is very informative. We need all of our people to know about these things. And we have to have you back because I can see there's more information you have for us. But we are now at the end of this show. This is Onajima Weed, co-host, and also we have
Vicky Casanova Willis, co-host.
So we're going to sign off for Race Treaty and thank everyone for listening in. You can hear this podcast by going to the website. You can Google Race Treaty, and you will find a hyperlink there with all the podcasts. And when we have live shows, you can call 828-385-4922. Thank you very much for joining in. Good night.
Thank you so much, everyone.